Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, which is Mr. Rudyard Lynch, known most widely as What If Alt Hist, who does a very interesting channel on basically the rise and fall of civilizations and history and so forth. So, Rudyard, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure to have you on. A number of people have said to me in my live streams that you should have What If Alt Hist on, so I'm very pleased to be getting around to doing so. So you've got a very successful YouTube channel, over 600,000 subscribers. So how did you get into the old online influencing?
So I started it 10 years ago when I was bored, and I didn't plan on any of this happening, partly because this wasn't even a job 5 years ago. And I did a thing called Alternate History, which is like, what if the Nazis won the Civil War, and what if the South won the Second World War? And I did that for the longest time. And then I got stuck at home during COVID, and I started switching over. I started working my YouTube channel full time when I was stuck at COVID. And then it became my full time job as I started doing it professionally. And now we're here. And through studying alternate history, because I was constantly trying to figure out, if blank thing happened in history, what would the end result be? And then I ended up studying a lot of actual history. And now I discuss topics like anthropology, history, geopolitics, philosophy, and explaining how the world works. And it kind of just happened.
Did you do a history degree?
No, I didn't. I went to college for a semester.
But not history. History's come about later.
No, for the one semester I went to school, I did a history degree, but I didn't finish it.
Okay. And whereabouts in America are you from? Because you have this accent, which I find hard to pin down.
I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm from an hour outside Philadelphia. I live like 20 minutes from where Malcolm Collins grew up. I live 20 minutes from where Malcolm Collins lives.
Oh, well, I've been
there.
I'm
in Texas right now. Sorry?
I've been to where Malcolm Collins lives.
Yeah, that's where I grew up.
I don't recall them talking like that, but anyway, there you go. All right. So anyway, alternative history. Now, one of the things that I was very interested in on your channel is, and I'm interested in general in the research I've done, is cycles of civilization and parallels, albeit not necessarily precise parallels, but parallels between different periods in history and now, and how this helps us to make sense of what's going on now, and therefore make predictions about what might happen as a consequence. And one of the parallels that you've discussed in some detail, and you discussed it in relation to the ability for men to get married and stuff as well, which was very interesting, was the French Revolution. The idea that what we're going through is kind of paralleling the French Revolution. Could you expand on why that's the case?
There's a handful of cycles I look at, one being the civilizational cycle that Spengler talks about, which is at 2,000 years, and the easiest parallel to current Western civilization is the Greco-Romans, where the time period we sync up with is the fall of the Roman Republic. Then you have a shorter cycle, around 100 years, and you have the generational cycle, which is 80 years, and I'm developing my new system that I'll make a video on for the 100-year cycle, where each era of modernity has a 100-year cycle punctuated by a major war, with World War I, the Napoleonic Wars, the 30 Years' War, etc. The cycle which links us up with the French Revolution is the secular cycle, which was first developed by Fernand Braudel, did a little bit of stuff on that. Then David Hackett Fisher wrote a book on it, and Peter Turchin developed the computer model to model it. And so the last time this cycle played through in the Western world was the French Revolution. And it's driven off three variables that you can plug into a computer to calculate when these events happen. Those being income inequality, average wages, and competition for elite jobs. And off these three variables, you can plug that data into a historic time period and predict the French Revolution, the fall of the Roman Republic, the Russian Revolution, the Black Death, the 30 Years' War, and these happen in rhythmic historic cycles that occur roughly every 250 years. So French Revolution, 30 Years' War, Black Death, Crusades, fall of the Frankish Empire. You could go backwards.
So you're saying you've got the 80-year cycle, the kind of Strauss-Howian cycle where there's a war and a collapse. And in that sense, we parallel 1929 or the 1930s. But then there's a further 250-year, I wasn't aware of this, a 250-year further mini-cycle.
Yes.
Where we parallel the French Revolution, which is about 200 years ago. And then is there a further one, or is it just the whole civilizational cycle after that?
Let me pull out the books I have for each of these. You can cut this segment out if you don't want to.
Sometimes when I think of multiple cycles,
and you have Spengler's, which is 2,000 years long, and that cycle stems from, it's a macro civilizational cycle, so the rise and fall of a civilization, and there have been three of those. There's the Mesopotamian Bronze Age cycle, the Iron Age Greco-Roman one, and the modern Western one. So this is the larger one. Carol Quigley wrote about it a lot too. And Peter Turchin developed the 250-year cycle, yes.
Okay. And then, in what way does our situation parallel the 250-year cycle? Did it culminate in the French Revolution?
So there's about 20 variables you can use to predict this. And the three biggest ones I told about before, being mostly relating to economics. And what occurs here is that everything in the natural order is a feedback loop to itself, in that every, as Aristotle said, every process pushed to its natural extension destroys itself and becomes something new. And so what happens is that you've had a period of bloodletting, which creates a new period of prosperity. In that period of prosperity, the population grows, and afterwards it grows, and then afterwards you see a labor imbalance where capital and labor are constantly competing with the other, or they're in a reciprocal relationship. And then as labor gets cheaper, it pushes the average value of a person's wages down, and it increases inequality because capital's ability to mobilize labor increases. So you've seen a growth in inequality, and then you see competition for the few good elite jobs. And then what occurs is that the elite breaks into sub-factions, pushing each self-interest. For example, in the French Revolution, the Royalists versus the Jacobins.
Why is there an overpromotion of elites in the first place? How does that process occur?
When you have a society in which there's not enough, when you have a society where there's not enough good, in an unequal society, you have most jobs are terrible and a small amount of good jobs. And thus people compete for the small amount of good jobs because there's a disparity where only a handful of these jobs actually work and most will leave you in poverty. And so there's hyper competition for the good positions in the inequality, which is why in our society, for example, people are getting college degrees, and that why people are constantly getting PhDs and master's degrees, which don't lead them anywhere because they're overcompensating for a handful of good jobs that don't exist. And it's also, for example, a major reason why you see diversity and equity jobs, because what's effectively going on there, in my opinion, or at least a major facet of it, is that with these diversity and equity jobs, you can throw merit out the window. And so you can hire mostly people of color, but also the pre-established elites, they can use the obfuscated system to put their children in power because they've removed merit. And it's also a way to hijack the system for leftist ideologues who would, on a purely merit basis, not be able to get these good positions. And so the society splits apart into different self-interests based on certain subgroups of the population. And so in our society, at least in America, I don't know if it's the same in Europe, the breakdown is the college educated versus the non-college educated, where every single policy the left pushes the self-interest of the college educated. And you look at that for police, you look at that through economics, through social workers over religious leaders, anything you would look for the left does is to give the college-educated bureaucrat more power, while the right pushes the non-college-educated elite, whether business, military, or religious interests. And so what's happening is that as the amount of good jobs shrinks, the right and the left fight over, will the resources go to the college educated or the non-college educated? And the previous historic parallels, like let's say from the 14th century or the 15th century, is the Yorkists and the Lancastrians. They were different geographic parts of England. The parliamentarians and the royalists were capitalist versus landed gentry. And across history, you see that there's different, as times get tough, the population splits into different sub-demographics that have civil wars to push their group's interests.
Right. What would be the opposite? When was there a period where there were enough good jobs? And so you didn't get this competition?
These happen in rhythmic cycles, where the last good time in the Western world was the mid-20th century. Where in the mid-20th century, the Western world had very low political stress because you didn't have to try that hard. Where if you were a genuinely smart person in 1955, you could just get a job. And so you've satiated basically the will to power inside the population. And you can count, for a longest time, I wanted to make an economic metric about, can you afford to have three children in your society? Because I think that's a very important metric, because as I frequently say, humans are designed to breed first and be rational later. And three children is fundamentally what you need to maintain your family's replication. And we're in a society where most people can't afford to have any children. And at least with the social standards that we have in the West for quality of life. And so everyone could afford to do that in the 50s. If you want to go through these rhythmic cycles, the early 18th century was another good time. The 15th century was, parts of the 19th century were depending where you were in the Western world. And so it's these alternating rhythms between time periods.
What is it that makes it a good time, that people feel that their desire for status is safe?
Wage work versus cost of living, where if you're a normal person, you work at the factory, can you make enough money to support a family comfortably and not be on the edge of survival? Where Peter Turchin's work, he's analyzes about 20 different variables, and a lot of these variables are contiguous across different historic time periods. So for example,
the reason why in the 50s you were better able to do that than you are now is because the standard of living, the desired material standard of living was lower. Most people didn't go on holiday abroad or go on holiday at all. All of these things that we consider to be essential, you know, large materialistic Christmases. Roast chicken was something that was expensive.
There's an obfuscation here in that luxury items became cheaper, but quality standard living stuff became more expensive. And Turchin is a great example of this. And I like looking at holistic variables as well as normal stuff like housing, where housing, healthcare, university, food, oil, all the basic essentials were incredibly cheap in the 50s. And also we've seen a push against labor vis-a-vis capital, where the supply for labor has exceeded capital by 40% over the last 50 years. And this has occurred for a significant amount of reasons, whether the supply of foreign immigration, women entering the workforce, automation, globalization. The elites have done every single thing they could do to lower the value of labor, because of course they do. It's inside their direct self-interest. And you can look at a bunch of other proxies behind that, besides that, where Turchin has developed 20 different metrics to compute rough well living. And you can see variables like average height, which even among white people has been in decline, average age of marriage, amount of sleep people get, rates of obesity, and rates of deaths of despair. And I like looking at the marriage rates and the deaths of despair rates, because it's impossible to look into someone's soul, but you can find various metrics to determine their general well-being. And at the same time, if it doesn't really matter how poor someone actually is. What matters on the sociological level is how poor they believe themselves to be. Where I went to Egypt 2 years ago, and Egyptians are far poorer than Americans, but they've relatively done better than they were 30 years ago. So Egyptians are happier they're happier with the poorness they have because it's better than what their parents had. Well, Americans are vastly wealthier than Egyptians, but our expectations are higher. And in America, if you pull a third world or pull a pre-industrial and keep six kids in a one-room house and like have a single pair of clothes for them, the police will be called on you. Like your kids will get taken away, or you'll be socially outcasted at the very least. And so it's the perceived economic utility of the people in the society versus what their expectations are.
I see.
I would like to address something briefly. In many of my videos, I talk about our evolutionary backgrounds and how our social behavior today is naturally predisposed. But in doing so, I often assume that you have a basic knowledge of our evolutionary history. This includes not only our descent from apes, but also the history of how we differentiated into different races and peoples. Of course, you can watch all my videos and gather the information from the bits and pieces that I've done, as well as reading up on the sources yourself. But to make it easier for you, there is a good book called Who We Are and How We Got Here by Harvard psychologist Professor David Reich. This book is special because it was one of the first to incorporate the new findings of archaeogenetics. This means that DNA is extracted from ancient bone findings and analysed. Based on these data, we know exactly which peoples migrated from where to where and when. The ancestors of us Europeans, for example, the so-called Indo-Europeans or Yamnaya, probably came from the steppe around 3000 BC and conquered Europe. If you want to hear a short summary of the most important info in this extremely interesting book, you can do so at Leogent.com. You can listen to this and many other base titles in under 25 minutes. The difference between Leogent and other similar platforms is that only Leogent covers the really relevant books on topics such as our evolutionary origins as Europeans. So try it now. Go to Leogent.com now and sign up with my promo code TJH to get 10% off.
Yeah, my parents were school teachers, and they bought their house for about double a teacher's salary in 1982. And the teacher's salary has now probably doubled since then, but the house has gone up about, you know, sort of sixfold. So you can't. There's no way that two school teachers these days could buy that house. And so I think it's those kinds of things. And so did you have so? Okay, I see what you mean then. So how does this parallel the French Revolution situation? What was going on there?
Yes. So there's a series of variables you can use to predict this. Real estate's one of them, as you touched on. So before these crises, the price of real estate skyrockets. The price of basic essentials skyrocket. You see mass inflation. And for example, right now, the average young person puts 70% of their income, and this is across the Western world, into rent. And so that's a great example, because it demonstrates capital's dominance over the society, where, for example, as of now, the U.S. government's pushing all this artificial money into the economy to maintain social stability. But at the same time, that ends up in places like the stock market or real estate, which lowers the quality of life for normal people. But as to get to your question, I believe there are a couple important similarities between the French Revolution and the modern Western world. I think especially so America, in that it always shocks me people don't realize that you have a ruling class which is completely disconnected from the populace and pretty stupid, and they don't comprehend that there is this giant demographic of young men who are basically incapable of achieving the things that they want for life, and the elite ritually humiliates them in every way possible. But in America, at least, the demographic that's that is being put down by the society is exceptionally well-armed. And if you look at red versus blue America, conservative America, it has the military, the police, the gun owners, veterans, it has all the natural terrain and the geographic majority of the country. And so it always shocks me to compare how the elites just completely disconnected from the potential.
Haven't they made a lot of efforts to wokeify the police, to wokeify the army, and infiltrate it with woke ideas? Surely they have, haven't they?
In the military in the U.S., the upper brass of the military has been wokeified, while the ranks themselves tilt conservative. And it's comparable to the French and the Russian revolutions, where before those conflicts, the top ranks of the military were royalists, while most of the soldiers were pro-revolutionaries. And so when the revolution started, people listened to their colonels who agreed with them and were identifiable, not to the generals or admirals. And the thing is that in America, young men tilt 2 or 3 to 1 conservative to progressive. So young men are most of the fight in wars. Young men are the ones who fight. So if young men as a general tilt conservative, that means you have a massive imbalance of force. And just on a practical level, the left thinks masculinity, militarism, hierarchy, discipline, using force are moral wrongs. And it's hard to have a war when you think all these things are morally objectionable.
Well, but they were prepared to go in and physically arrest the January 6th protesters and that sort of thing and put them in prison. I mean, that's using force.
It's one of my friends, Kurt Doolittle, I think he's one of the most important thinkers of our time. And he's developed this whole theory that the left is toxic femininity. And it's really brilliant. And one of the points he makes is the left's main strategy is baiting into hazard. The left acts in a covert way to try to trigger the right to do something dumb so that it can then use legal force to say the right is dangerous and wipe out the right. And in situations, the left is willing to use force on a minimal basis in order to ensure their power. Yet on a larger scale, they fold. Where, for example, they won't evict the homeless from city centers, or how do you orchestrate a military operation among leftists? They don't have anyone in their coalition who would fight except ethnic minorities, and I can't really imagine woke commanders organizing black soldiers. It's just too much of a cultural difference, And there's no part of the left's ideology that allows them to inflict to actually use force upon their enemies.
Mm. Yes, I suppose they use things like financial punishment and and social ostracism, sort of female tactics, as opposed to traditional male tactics. So all right, that's the point. Yes, so you've got a young men who are increasingly feeling that they can't get what they want. And then couldn't it be argued that the kind of men that have a bit of conscientiousness, a bit of intelligence, a bit of get up and go, they'll be much more likely to get what they want. And it will be the kind of men that can be distracted via bread and circuses or very realistic porn or computer games that don't get what they want. And they're not going to have much get up and go to fight anyway.
So if you look at these wars and revolutions, what you generally find is most of the population is apathetic. Where before the English Civil War is a really fascinating example of this, in that before the English Civil War, most people said, we don't want a war. It's same with the American Revolution or the U.S. Civil War. Then what happens is that you have small cadres of radicals who push the populace. And normal people never organize. So when war comes, their opinions largely don't matter. And so you see in the Russian Civil War, the radical Jacobins who made up less than 3% of Russia's population at the start the Bolsheviks win. For the French Revolution, the Jacobins, which are also like 1 or 2% of France's population, won. In America, the radical Republicans won out in the Civil War. They were a tiny part of the population. Same thing again with the Puritans, who are 10% of England's population, who won. Hardcore revolutionary sentiment in America was not big before the revolution.
It's not so much radicals. So it's not so much that it fits in with, sorry, with I don't know if you've read Nima Parvini's book, The Populist Delusion. It's not so much that you have a large number of men who are pissed off. It's that you have men, a group of men within the elite that are pissed off, that can draw upon the pissed off populace and mobilize.
And what I expect to happen in America is that we have because if you look at these crises, they normally start with a budget issue. A budget issue or an external war. That's the case with the French Revolution, English Civil War, French medieval and early modern wars, etc. And what I expect to happen, and you see the U.S. is constantly renewing its budgets every few months, and the debt's getting to an insane level. And so my top bet is that past a certain point, someone realizes that they have a higher chance of getting reelected if they start a war than if they don't start a war. And frankly, I look at the U.S. debt in the immigration. I don't think we can go another 4 years without having a war, because you just won't have a country left. And the left has been using short-term strategies to please the insane people at the heart of their coalition at the expense of the rest of their coalition. And so there's a couple of triggers, with the debt being one, foreign immigration being another, an external war being another. And there's like five more. I don't know exactly which one. But what I expect to happen is that the red states and the blue states, the red states form an independent government in Texas. Other red states support them. And the fascinating thing is that when Texas said no to Washington, the other 25 other states said they supported Texas over Washington in a one-day period, and 10 of those states offered military support to Texas, and they said they'd send their soldiers to Texas to fight for Texas. And the fact that it all happened in a single day, and for wars, you see how many dominoes can fall at once, where there were about 15 places where World War I nearly started before it started. And what that signifies to me is that World War I had to happen. It was just looking for a place where the match could get lit. And once I see that many dominoes fall in a row, it means that there's an underlying energy there that's going to get tapped. And sorry, it's taking me a second to actually get to your point. What I expect to happen, small groups of radicals in each faction will conscript the normies. And so you'll basically have right-wing and left-wing ideological new elites form. And they will conscript normal guys off the bar floor who don't want to fight.
Right. Okay. And how does this? So, what was this day? This specific day when 25 states sided with Texas. When was this?
That was with Greg Abbott's border issue, where Biden has been letting 15 million or 10, 8, whatever. We don't have good numbers. Biden has let between 8 to 15 million immigrants cross the border. Because he just let go of the border, and Texas didn't like that. And so Texas sent a letter to the U.S. government saying, we will block the border if you don't. And this breaks the U.S. Constitution, because states aren't allowed to block a foreign border. But then Texas sued the centralized government saying, you're not doing your duty, so we have to. And then within the next day of that, half the states in the country said that they supported Texas in doing this. And then Biden folded and backed down on the issue and let Texas block its border.
Oh, okay. When was this?
This was like 2 months ago.
Okay, that's very interesting. They didn't really report that in much detail here in Europe.
It does shock me to see what news doesn't cross the Atlantic, because I remember
that was quite big. That should actually been quite big news, I would have thought.
Yeah, because I remember in 2020, I heard. Europe, I always hear news from Europe about some horrifying, like, government overreach. And then it shocks me that I never hear about it in America. And I think that the media has more control over what news travels than a lot of people think. In that, Britain jails four times as many people for political dissent as Russia does this year.
That doesn't surprise me, because political dissent involves saying a man's a man and a woman's a woman. But carry on then. So with the parallel with the French Revolution, I want to get to the nub of this. So you've got the situation. Basically, so what you're saying is that if the economy is bad, then there are fewer elite jobs, but you have too many people that are trained into elite positions. So there's jostling among the elite for those positions. And so then you get a division among the elite, fighting among the wannabe elites or whatever. And you get also discontented men, and it's difficult to start a family and get a girl, which means there's lots of sexually frustrated, angry, aimless men out there. Plus, of course, with the French Revolution, food prices are very high and people are starving. So these are the main parallels, are they?
I agree with all of that.
Is there anything else that I have missed?
I mean, I have over 10 hours of content about this, so there's going to be you've got the basic fundamentals right, and I could go for another 3 days going into the details.
Why does it go into cycles of that length though? I mean, it's interesting that you get the 1,000-year cycle, the 250-year cycle, and the 100-year or 80-year cycle. Do you have any reason why?
With the secular cycles that I describe, there's two different lengths, one for monogamous societies and one for polygamous societies. Polygamous societies go through this cycle at half the length that monogamous ones do, because the elites overproduce too quickly, where, for example, in North Africa or the Mongols, their nations would fall apart every 120 years rather than 250. And that's why Ibn Khaldun said that it takes 120 years to move through these kinds of cycles, because from the Muslim world he lived in, that was generally accurate. And the Ottomans broke out of that system through just killing all the other descendants. But the 250-year cycle, it stems from human biology, in that it roughly takes that long to regrow the population after the last cycle, and also to lose the moral tethers that happened with the last cycle. And so it's based off, like, once you pass a certain amount of generations, it occurs.
Because there's a guy called Jani Miettinen, Finnish researcher. Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't.
And he says that in reindeer, you get these cycles across every four generations where they vary in size and in behavior. Right. And it's a way of avoiding predation and of being better predators or whatever. And these cycles are in hormones like testosterone and oxytocin. Yes. And a number of other hormones, and they parallel things like you get this in humans, and it comes every four generations, and it parallels in things like how tall people are, whether they breastfeed, and these can be predicted across four generations. And they
your audio cut out.
Where at what point?
You said that the reindeer cycles occur within a certain 4-year cycle, and it occurs in humans as well.
Yeah, and that it's certain hormones that are powering this, such as testosterone and oxytocin and a couple of others, and he reckons that this completely makes sense also of the 80-year Strauss-Howe cycle. So I wonder how a 250-year broader cycle might fit into some of these kinds of biological possibilities.
That's a great question, and it leads to a point that I've talked about a lot, where history is a biological cycle, and people's hormones reflect where they are in history. And if you look at when the revolution starts, people want to be violent on a visceral biological level, that their bodies force them to do that. And humans, we are really manifestations of our genetics, and our genetics control our conscious mind, at least to a large degree. And so there are certain situations where we're not really making a rational calculation, but our instincts just go out. And so when you look at a period like the French Revolution, the rage that the lower classes feel against the upper classes is visceral, and the elites... I was talking to a friend where most people are not cognizant of these issues, and they will continue to not be cognizant of them until things really get to a head and get really bad. And so them not noticing it is also a biological strategy, since if they noticed what was going on, they wouldn't have the actual, they wouldn't know how to deal with it. And so they're biologically incentivized to not figure out what's happening, because that's not a strategically useful strategy yet.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. There is something evolutionarily adaptive about ignorance. Like whether you think there's a God or there isn't, if we can agree that there are no really logical arguments for the existence of God, but it seems to be adaptive to believe in God. It's adaptive. And so if there is no God, then it's adaptive to believe something that's false. Because it makes you less stressed, it makes you able to cope with your own mortality, it makes you more pro-social, because you've got God on the shoulder telling you. And so it is literally assuming that we live in a mechanical universe, then it's adaptive to not see certain things.
Or you see something comparable with envy, where a thread I've talked about in a lot of my videos is that envy is one of the most powerful forces in society. And envy is bad on the social basis, but you look at populations which envy other, like for the left, for example, it's inside their biological self-interest to predate from the successful in society. So they develop this entire ideology to justify predating upon people. And so they're creating this worldview to further their self-interests, making it moral.
Yeah, and that's right. They're justifying what is their evolutionary strategy, which is that if you are at the bottom of society and you're weak and you're mentally unstable and fear a fair fight, then the only way you can play for status is via virtue signaling. So that's what they do. But then they just say, oh, well, this is kindness and love, and we should all be lovely and equal. And actually, it's a way of getting power. Or with women, there's research. I don't know if you've read Joyce Benenson's book, Warriors and Warriors. And on a certain level, women won't even kind of almost consciously be aware that they're ambitious. They won't even be aware that they're acting in an ambitious way. They'll actually genuinely think that all people are equal and they're equal and other. But they are acting. They are. Under the hood, acting in such a way, and then suddenly they're the one that gets the best man, that bags the alpha man.
I mean, also just look outside. That's the reality we live in. Women, men will often admit malice. Women never will. A Viking warlord who's killed a bunch of people and raped a bunch of women, he'll be proud of that. There's no female equivalent for the girl who gossips and then makes all the other girls not reproductively successful, so she marries the Lord. She's never going to glory in that victory. And my friend Homath, he runs a great dating YouTube channel, and he made his favorite video. My favorite video of his is called Who's a 10, where he talks about why women like to say, we're all 10s, we're all beautiful. And his argument is that behind the hood for that is that it's strategically useful for all the different social levels of attractiveness for women to pretend that they're all stunningly beautiful, because that increases their negotiating level across the sex. And so women do that, in my opinion, where they establish comfortable falsehoods that they all agree on as a union, and then foist them upon society.
I foist them upon each other.
Yes.
While unconsciously not believing them.
Yes. So
it's interesting the way that women, whenever a woman goes a bit mad and cuts her hair short, which almost always makes her look less good.
Yes.
It's always the women that say, oh, I do love your new haircut. Oh, you look so nice. Oh, whatever.
Yes.
Of course, no, you don't. You've cut your hair short and you look rubbish. But it's in the interests of other women to make you want to cut your hair short, because then you're not a competition to them.
Literally everything in feminism is mate suppression.
Are you ready for the future of the West?